things over to Todd Wagner. Todd, can I turn things over to you?
Yeah, thanks, Rob. I appreciate it. I just wanted to introduce our speaker for today. Matt is a senior research career scientist at the Durham VA and a professor at the Duke Margolis Center for Health Policy. And at the Durham VA, he is a director of the Non-Randomized Design Lab. And one of his specialties, and it's part of what he's going to be talking about today, is causal inference from observational data. And as many of you know, we sit on a wealth of VA data. And the questions that we're trying to figure out are questions often about causality and mechanisms. And today he's going to be talking about heterogeneous treatment effects with instrumental variables, which is a key method in causal inference. So I am super pleased to have Matt presenting today. So Matt, take it away.
Thanks very much. Todd, it's nice to be with you all today. And let me just say that people should just jump in with questions whenever you have them. Over the course of the presentation, you don't need to hold questions at the end. Hopefully we can do that and make this more of an exchange, and yet I can still get through the whole presentation. And I may not be able to see the chat, so if you do want to stop me, just speak up. And I want to thank Edwin Wong at the Seattle Coin for reviewing these slides, and to Paul Hebert for some slides that you'll see in a bit. So assuming I can advance things, yes. So disclosures, some of this work is informed by some of this HSR&D funding, and my wife owns Amgen stock due to her employment. So I just want to note that. So here's the basic agenda. You know, this is maybe familiar to you if you've gotten any coursework or prior experience in causal inference methods or observational study design. So there's reasons why non-randomized studies sometimes are challenged in generating unbiased treatment effect estimates, say, and the implication of that bias spills over into how we interpret results. And IV analysis can help us address some of this bias, of one particular kind of bias that we'll talk about, but requires some assumptions, sometimes that are steep. And then we'll talk about the heterogeneity part of the title is really centered around how we interpret IV results in the context of marginal patients. And then we'll talk about that in the context of this Rachel Werner, good VA colleague of all of ours, because they implemented an IV analysis in a 2019 JAMA Internal Medicine paper of an analysis of Medicare patients, not veterans. and then I'll, yeah. Give some examples of some instruments at the end. So maybe no surprise, right? VA and other health systems need answers to pressing questions, but for feasibility, ethics, or other reasons, trials aren't going to be available to answer them all. And so we have to rely upon non-randomized studies to answer some questions about treatments working as intended, either for those who got them, which is the average treatment effect on the treated, or for eligible patients who might be randomly chosen for the treatment. Because VA's obviously got a lot of things it's trying to do, both improve and to change. Management of long COVID is certainly a new and pressing one. How to do that well is not yet established. We're just standing up treatments, long COVID clinics, and other approaches to managing long COVID. We still don't know how to identify those folks very well, but presumably once we get some candidate effective treatments, we're going to really, and those are not going to be randomized to veterans. We are going to want to characterize whether those are working as intended or not. IV analysis may be one way we want to go about trying to evaluate that question. And in any analysis we're doing, right, we're evaluating some outcome Y as a function of the treatment and other covariates. And in many, many contexts, the full range of covariates that we that might explain variation in the outcome are not measured. Those that are unmeasured are in the error term U, which is a combination of random error and those unobserved confounders and predictors. And so there is bias in randomization, in the absence of randomization. Maybe this is old news to everybody, right? Because it causes the treatment variable and the error term, the U, to be correlated. And those error term, those unobserved confounders maybe are probably treatment specific. There may be particular general ability factors Patients may know they do better under one treatment than another, or in the treatment compared to control or usual care. There may be compulsiveness things and behavioral interventions, perceived risk of COVID, but you know what the unobserved confounders or predictors might be of outcome are treatment specific. If somehow we know, have a very good understanding of the outcome data generating process for the outcome, and we happen to be very thoughtful about our measurements, or the number of risk factors that explain variation in the outcome are narrow, it may be that our X's, our measured covariates, are exhaustive. And in that case, that we can assume that the error term U may be close to random. And through that exhaustive measurement issue, then the covariance between treatment and the error term is close to zero. If treatment's randomly allocated, then the correlation between treatment and U is zero, assuming no attrition and other things. But we're not in that world typically in trying to figure out how we're going to treat long COVID. That's not going to be randomly allocated. And presumably our understanding of the covariates that drive outcome variation are incomplete and evolving. And so unobserved confounding can't be ruled out. And so in that context, the covariance between treatment and the residual is not equal to zero. Because of this private information people have or our incomplete understanding of the data generating process. And so that's where we may need to think about IV. And so in the absence of randomization, interpretation is difficult. Essentially, jumping to the third bullet, if the treatment is not null, is it due to the treatment working? Say, if outcomes are better in those who get treatment than those that don't, is it because the treatment's working? Or is it because healthy patients get it, or some combination of both? And if it's some combination of both, then we would be concerned about overestimating the treatment effect compared to, say, a randomized trial of a similar population with the treatment delivered as it is in the real world. And let me just sort of describe that in a very simplistic figure, right? So in the context of a trial, we know if randomization is effective, there's no selection. Right, treatment group and control group look similar on average. And then we run the trial, no mean feat. And then we sit around and wait till the outcomes are available. And then we run an analysis of the outcome as a function of the treatment. And we get three possible results shown in the columns. It's either the outcomes for the treatment group are worse than those of the control group, the outcomes are similar between the two arms, or outcomes in the treatment group are better than the control group. And on the basis of the result of that coefficient, as it were, on the treatment, we can then have an interpretation by looking at the top of the column, right? If the outcomes in the treatment group are better than those in the control group, we can interpret the treatment to be protective. In the absence of randomization, though, we now have 9 possible scenarios crossing the possible simple selection combinations and effectiveness of treatment. And so in one simple scenario, let's take, we don't say we didn't look at selection. We didn't look at a table one. We just went straight to the outcome equation and estimated the effect of the treatment on the outcome. Well, in fact, there's 5 possible interpretations if we find that outcomes in the treatment group are better than those in the control group, right? So hopefully this is obvious. And the upper left and the bottom right, where it's greater than or less than, it depends on whether the treatment effect swamps the selection effect. So I hope that's straight. And so it's important for us to characterize the selection effect in non-randomized studies, because we don't want to find ourselves in this scenario. And I'm assuming that's obvious to everyone. So how do we proceed? We shouldn't just estimate the treatment equation or the outcome equation as a function of treatment, unless we can identify proxy measures for the key unobserved confounders and add those to the equation, in order to minimize how much unobserved confounding we think we're going to be stuck with at the end. That strategy is not always available, maybe rarely available, at least it's not to me in my work. So then we have 2 other approaches. We can do propensity score matching or weighting, which doesn't address unobserved confounding, or we can consider instrumental variable methods. And that requires having a valid instrument, which I'll talk about in a bit. And so, you know, IV analysis requires now not just the estimation of the outcome equation. Now we have to identify what drives treatment Because that's, as you do in a propensity score, right? It's, we are going to try to characterize what is predicting who chooses treatment and who doesn't, as a function of covariates and this new term Z, which is the instrument. Propensity scores has the same specification except no Z, right? And we know we can observe someone's treatment status on the basis of whether they chose treatment or they did not. And so for each person, we see some treatment status TX as a function of what they chose. And in the ideal world of perfect compliance, the probability of treatment, everyone who's, selects treatment sees it through, and everyone who chooses not treatment sees it through. But in reality, we often have non-compliance. And so if we want to go down the path of IV analysis, we have to meet some of these assumptions. The first one is directly testable, which is that we have this equation right up above that the treatment is a function of some X's, the instrument, and we need that instrument to be predictive of treatment assignment. If it's totally unpredictive, then it's not a strong instrument. And the definition of a strong instrument is that the F test on the alpha 2 is greater than 10. That's kind of a rule of thumb. Right, because in the same way that coin flips tend to be a good predictor of treatment assignment in trials, even if there's non-compliance, we need our instrument to be a strong predictor of treatment assignment. The second assumption, which is referred to as the exclusion restriction, is that the instrument should be uncorrelated with the outcome and the residual of the outcome equation. That is often argued through storytelling, I guess I'd say, or people sometimes might look at median split, where you generated table 1 based upon the median value of the instrument with people above and below the median value. You look at outcome values. If the outcomes look similar on the basis of the median split, then that can be some indication that maybe it's a reasonable instrument. And there are other assumptions about monotonicity and stable unit treatment assumption that are standard assumptions in IV. I'm not going to talk about those. Other assumptions, if you're interested in learning more about those, there's a really beautiful paper by Dana Goldman and Jay Bhattacharya and others in the 2001 issue of JASA, the Journal of the American Statistical Association, that walked through all the assumptions in IV, of IV, and in an appendix. Actually talk about in the context of their study of insurance status and HIV related mortality, how their instrument meets those assumptions. It's really lovely. So not having herd effects is a big one. And in the world of COVID and trying to understand management of COVID, there are likely herd effects, right? With COVID infection. So that's some situation where SIFA might not hold. Okay, so assuming we have an instrument that meets these assumptions, what can you do? How do you implement IV analysis? Well, out of the treatment equation, out of any equation, right, you can generate predicted outcomes and residuals by taking the difference between the observed value and the predicted value, right? And so in this treatment equation, you can get those same two terms, right? Predicted treatment, the TX hat, or the residual, taking that difference as shown in the slide. And the first approach makes use of the predicted treatment status. That's the two-stage least squares approach. And the second approach is two-stage residual inclusion, where you basically take the observed value of treatment and into the original outcome equation, add into this essentially predicted residual. And the details for around two-stage residual inclusion are discussed in detail in the Terza and Basu paper. I'm not going to go into it further here. Let me stop there and see if there are any questions. I'm going awfully fast.
Nothing yet. So I'm just monitoring the Q&A. So if people have Q&As, people can easily type stuff in and I'm happy to address it or pass it on to Matt.
Okay. Well, I'll keep going then. So in IV analysis, we assume that there's imperfect compliance. That has a real implication for how we generalize results from IV. That is, to whom do IV results generalize? In a conventional analysis, not accounting for this endogeneity or sample selection, that is the covariance between treatment and the residual, if we just run our outcome equation, that result will be biased, but it has, I guess, the benefit of generalizing to the entire analytic cohort. But under the assumption that there's imperfect compliance in non-randomized studies, it implies a couple things about the composition of the treatment group and the composition of the control group. In the treatment group, imperfect compliance assumes that there are always takers who would always take treatment regardless of the value of the instrument, and that there's compliers whose decision to take treatment is informed by the value of the instrument. Let me give you an example that's kind of out of the Werner paper that we'll talk about a little later, right? It could be that, right, in that paper, they were looking at patients who were hospitalized and upon discharge, were they discharged home with home health care, or were they discharged to a skilled nursing facility? And the instrument in that analysis was relative distance. That is, the difference in the distance from home and from the distance from home to the nearest SNF, right? And so there may be people who live essentially next door to a SNF, so that going but the hospital's far from their home, so that it's incredibly convenient for them to go to the SNF because it's so close in proximity to the hospital. And so those types of patients may be compliers because of the value of relative distance. That is, it's very close to the SNF. In the control arm, there's other two types of groups, subgroups comparably. There's never takers, that is, people who would never take treatment under any circumstance. And then there's a similar group of compliers who chose not treatment because of the value of the instrument. And so because of each, the treatment arm and the control arm having this composition of these two subgroups, the implication is that in the context of imperfect compliance, and the instrument doesn't inform treatment selection for always takers or for never takers. And so the treatment effect is really, since we're relying on the instrument to identify an unbiased treatment effect, that treatment effect generalizes only to the compliers. And these are referred to as marginal patients. There's a very nice paper by Catherine Harris and Dahlia Remler in Health Services Research from 2000, I think, that talks about this in a very accessible way. And so, unlike the original analysis that doesn't account for this selection problem that generalized to everybody and generates, say, an average treatment effect, what the IV analysis yields that generalizes to marginal patients only is called the local average treatment effect. It's also referred to as the complier average causal effect in the EPI literature. And what the late represents is the average treatment effect for patients that change treatment steps according to their treatment assignment, based driven by the instrument. But a fundamental challenge of the local average treatment effect is that we're not entirely sure who it generalizes to. It's not possible to know definitively who those marginal patients are. And so while we get an estimate that generalizes to compliers, the difference between compliers and the always takers and the compliers and the never takers are not well characterized in the treatment arm, unless somehow you did some prospective survey potentially of treatment seeking behavior that maybe might be able to give you some sense of it in the context of the treatment you're studying, maybe. I don't know, I just made that up. And so there's a fundamental challenge of IV interpretation because it only generalizes to compliers, as I've said, but there is a method that Baiacci, Chang, and Small have outlined in a Stats and Medicine paper in 2014 that's an attempt to characterize the compliers. And I would direct you to sections 5.2 to 5.3 of that paper for more details about how to do that. I'm not going to go through that here. So I now will walk through the Werner analysis that they published. And I should say I'm talking about this because there was a methods overview paper in JAMA published, I think, earlier this year, where we sort of walk through this in brief and try to introduce the issue of interpretation in IV and marginal patients. So in the Werner analysis, they asked the question, are hospital readmission and costs similar between patients discharged home with home health and patients discharged with skilled nursing facility? And they had 7 years of Medicare fee-for-service data in which to do this, a very large sample. And they revisited this question that had been examined in prior studies because prior literature, the results showed mixed results in terms of outcomes between patients discharged of these two settings. And they thought that there might be confounding by indication and that healthier patients who may be able to sort of self-manage and rehab at home with a little bit of home health might, you know, we might not characterize the health status and functionality in Medicare claims data fully to be able to adjust for that. So that may be an important unobserved confounder. And then it could also be the case that there's a difference in how complications and functional improvements are managed by setting. And so for those reasons, those were kind of the motivation for considering IV, because they were concerned that these might be unobserved confounders. And so what they were interested in estimating was the outcome equation of were you readmitted or not as a function of being discharged to either setting with adjusting for a bunch of X's. But since they wanted to do an IV analysis, they also had to estimate that equation, that is the probability of being discharged home with home health as a function of a bunch of X's and the instrument of differential distance, which is, as I'd said, distance from home to home health minus distance from home to the SNF. They tested their, to test the first assumption, you know, they generated an F statistic for that instrument and found that differential distance was an incredibly strong predictor of patient selection in a home health or SNF as their discharge setting, with an F test of 263.4, well above the threshold for 10. That's the rule of thumb. And they did not really formally test the second assumption, but made arguments. They did a falsification test as an indirect way, I guess, of assessing the second assumption, evaluating whether being admitted to hospitals far from the patient's home was similar between the two groups. And they found that their instrument differential distance was not predictive of admission far from home. So by that logic, they argued that it was a reasonable instrument. And interestingly, when doing a simple unadjusted comparison of readmission rates and then covariate adjusted kind of original analysis, found that readmission rates were lower if patients were discharged to home health. But when they implemented the IV analysis, the sign switched, which is uncommon, I guess I'd say, finding that patients discharged to home had a 5.6% higher readmission rate than patients discharged to SNFs. So quite a turn of events, I guess.
Can I say one thing,
Matt? Yes.
Can you get for that? So I often hear the concern is, yeah, we don't have instruments. We'll just do a correlational study. It's going to get us close enough. And this is one of those examples where not only was it not close enough, it was the opposite sign of the causal estimate. if we believe the IV results.
Right, right. So this reconciling, reconciling covariate adjusted results that don't account for selection and IV results that do account for selection is challenging, let me say, particularly when the sign switches. Because the covariate unadjusted and covariate adjusted results generalize the entire analytic cohort, but the IV results only generalize to the marginal patients. And so if the all three sets of results were in the same direction, it would lead you to say, so suppose it was 5% higher, a 5% lower readmission rate. So the covariate adjusted and unadjusted results were underestimating the true effect. When the sign switches, I struggle to know whether the covariate adjusted results are totally wrong for everybody, or is it that for the marginal patients, discharge to home health, does that switch in sign generalize to only marginal patients so that in a sense, there may be some patients for whom home health is protective, as it were, but for the marginal patients, it's not. So I struggle with that.
Thank you for sort of walking people through that. I think the only question, and if you want to get into the wars between correlational analysis and IV, Twitter's a great place to go. But there's among researchers, there's also, you know, compliers and never takers when it comes to IV versus, and you probably don't want to get into that debate here, but just to know that some people are really interested in trying to understand causal estimates. But it, like you point out, Matt, it doesn't always completely confirm or deny exactly what you're looking at when you see a covariate adjustment.
Right. Yeah, so I think this is clearly, I believe the IV results for the marginal patients, but since they don't generalize to everyone, for the non-marginal patients, I'm not sure what to make of it, let me just say. Which I know is kind of an unsatisfying response, but a strict, but I certainly know that there's a lot of people who would argue here that the IV results show that the covariate adjusted results are wrong, right? I feel like it may be more subtle than that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So to their credit, Rachel Werner and group did try to make clear to whom the results generalize. And this is something that I don't think is always carefully done in studies that use IV analysis. And so this is verbatim from the paper. And in italics is sort of what I'm trying to emphasize here, so that they really clearly try to say that these IV results only generalize to marginal patients. And anyone doing IV analysis would be doing a great service to the reader to include similar language in the method section and certainly in the discussion of the results in the discussion section. I have other slides. I must have not included, sent you the full set. Is it possible that I can? Do I have the ability to share slides?
Sure do, yep. Okay. If you.
I think I might have sent you.
I'll walk you through it when you're ready.
Bear with me for just 1 second. I would like to show additional slides that I must not have sent you. So if I can. I can share. Yeah. Okay.
If you click on share across the top there, file, edit, share.
Okay, great.
Share content, and then you could.
Okay. So I'm not. I think I basically. I need to send you an updated version. So let me discuss some more things to ground the marginal patient. The marginal patient problem concretely. And I'd like to thank Paul Heber. Can you see these?
Yes.
Okay. So this is a concrete, well, a hypothetical scenario that my good friend Paul Heber at the Seattle Coin came up with 10 years ago now, trying to bring some of the challenge of marginal patients' interpretation to life. Okay. And we did a series of workshops a decade ago, trying to teach people comparative effectiveness methods. And so a fair number of graduate students and junior faculty were attending those. So this example resonated, let me say. So suppose we're trying to evaluate the effect of beer on grades in the presence of unobserved despair, which if you graduated not too long ago from your PhD, you may remember. Or if you did, maybe you've repressed it and it's hard to bring it back up. But suppose that there's unobserved despair in our data set and people in the data set have various levels of despair, right? And then we have a host of observed confounders that we can adjust for. And our outcome is grades. And we're going to try to understand the effect of beer on grades. And but because despair we know is confounding the association between beer and grades, that if you have high levels of despair, you may drink more beer. And if you have high levels of despair, you may get worse grades. And so we want to isolate the effect of beer on grades, unconfounded by the unmeasured, the confounder of despair. And we need an instrument that can predict beer consumption that is not predictive of grades. Okay. And here's the genius of Paul's slides. So we have two instruments, suppose, that we can observe in regular data on students, whether they have a class that ends during happy hour and whether they have a class that ends on Friday afternoon. Why is that important? It's because there's four people, say four phenotypes in this data. And Paul was very prescient by having Joe Biden and Charlie Sheen as examples. And so there's four phenotypes. There's people like Charlie Sheen who are fabulously rich and inebriate, and they'll drink under any circumstance, regardless of the status of class ending on during a happy hour or on a Friday. So he's an always taker, right? If beer is the treatment. And then there's someone like me, who's a social drinker on a graduate student budget. So I'll drink if class ends during happy hour. And then there's my colleague here in Durham, Courtney Van Houtman, who's like me, a social drinker. And she might join me, but Friday nights, she plays basketball, so she can't, she'll never go drinking on a Friday. Whereas I'm happy to go on a Friday or if it's letting out during happy hour. And then there's Joe Biden, who's a teetotaler. He's the never taker because he's not had a drink in his life. And so the question is, who are the marginal patients in this example? Well, it depends on the instrument, right? Suppose the instrument is whether the class gets out on a Friday. Well, we see two people drinking that evening, two of these students. We see me and Charlie Sheen, right? But we see that Courtney and Joe didn't. But the reason that I'm the only marginal patient is it's because Courtney has basketball on Friday and she didn't drink because she had basketball. If it was a Thursday that we were observing this, we would see both Courtney and I being marginal patients. We wouldn't necessarily know that because we wouldn't know about these characteristics about basketball interests and stuff like that, right? But so the marginal patients would differ depending on the day of the week. This is an attempt to give a concrete example to what marginal patients might be. And unless we knew somehow in the data set that there's people like the Charlie Sheen's drinker types We wouldn't be able to know whether Charlie or I, in this example, are the marginal patients. We would just see both of us drinking, and we wouldn't know necessarily that results only generalized to me. Okay, so that's my little example of marginal drinkers, yeah, marginal patients. So let me end with a conversation about, well, we have IV. IV methods are a really handy tool to use if you can meet the assumptions. But in my experience, finding valid instruments is a lot harder than you might think. Normally, because the untestable second assumption seems hard to find, hard to satisfy in terms of telling stories about why an instrument is uncorrelated with the outcome or residuals in the outcome equation. But examples of instruments that have been used in the past are 4 types. The first 3 are here. First is relative distance, like Werner and her colleagues used, which first came to attention when Mark McClellan published his dissertation in JAMA in 1994, trying to understand the impact of cardiac catheterization on death, and used relative distance to hospitals that provide cardiac catheterization and hospitals that don't. And relative distance, I think, maybe works for emergent procedures where time is of the essence. And so wherever, you know, you have to get quickly for treatment, it may work. For elective procedures, maybe it's a little dicier. It depends on the context. Alan Brookhart had came up with a physician preference instrument in the context of medications. The intuition behind that is that clinical context where there's alternative treatments available, like antidepressants, typical or atypical antidepressants, which is the example done in the Wong study, there may be physicians who have a preference for a given one of the alternatives. And so in a way, going to see one provider almost, not entirely, but almost guarantees that you'll get one type of treatment. And if you go to a different provider, you'll get the alternative, one of the other alternatives. And this physician preference instrument has been used in a lot of pharmacoepi studies, and quite convincingly in this Phil Wong 2005 New England Journal paper that evaluated outcomes between, I think, death between patients who were initiating typical versus atypical antipsychotics. But in order to use this, you need to have alternative treatments available. If there's only one treatment available, this falls away. And then geographic variation has been used to, interestingly, in a paper by Teresa Stuckel and colleagues in 2007 in JAMA, trying to characterize the effect of cardiac catheterization on mortality, I think it was. And there have been a number of different studies that have used regional utilization rates of something to predict whether a patient in a region got it or not. The argument being that patients living in regions with high use rates of that technology may be more likely to get it than patients in regions with lower use of that technology. There's also policy changes in time that have been used as instruments. The first example is the Vietnam draft, which essentially randomly allocated people into military service based on birth dates, and to try to understand whether military service had impacts on patient outcomes, individuals' outcomes, in a really clever paper by Josh Angrist in 1990, where draft lottery essentially was almost perfectly predictive of whether you got into military service or not. There's obviously people like Dick Cheney and others who were able to actually defy and get out of that, but it's a very interesting paper, so I'd recommend it. Courtney Van Houten, my neighbor and apparently a marginal drinker, also did an interesting 2015 NBER paper looking at the effect of long-term care insurance on use of long-term care and using state variation and tax incentives for long-term care insurance as an instrument for predicting who got long-term care insurance at all. And then very interesting analysis about the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment with lottery numbers being given out to Medicaid applicants to determine essentially who was going to get Medicaid insurance when there was expansion, since they couldn't afford to give it to everybody who was eligible. And that's a really cool set of papers that they've done. Okay, I think I am now at the end of my talk. So in brief, IV methods can help to address unobserved confounding, but requires meeting pretty strong assumptions, only one of which is really testable. But if they're met, then you can quasi-randomize patients. A big trade-off is that inference is restricted to those who are complying, whose treatment allocations or self-selection is driven by the instrument. And so that's really about generalizing results to compliers, and that treatment effect estimate is referred to as the local average treatment effect. And compliers aren't necessarily identifiable, but this Biaggi method has some promise for being able to characterize in a general sense how compliers may differ from the overall population. And then I think the slides have a number of papers that I've mentioned in the course of this talk, and I'll stop there.
Great, thanks, Matt. So I encourage people to write in questions. Someone just posted that they love the Charlie Sheen example. Others should if they have questions and answers. Can you go back to question slide 29, I think it is, Matt, or the one before this with your examples of instruments, and maybe you can't easily go back. So the one thing I was going to point out, and maybe just a comment rather than a question, is that I think we've all tried a lot of these types of instruments, and they often fail more often than they succeed. So let me just pick on the Wang 2005 physicians. It breaks down if patients are choosing their physicians. It's one thing if you assume, for example, that the patient just showed up, they were assigned to this random provider or as good as random provider, the random provider had strong preferences and then starts prescribing according to those strong preferences. You're sort of getting randomly allocated into a randomized trial. But if the patients at different levels start seeking out their providers, let's just say you've got a hip procedure or a knee procedure that's got to get done, and you want to get the best surgeon, then the surgeon is a terrible instrument.
Your point being is informed patients who do doctor shopping looking for a particular treatment violates the assumption that
Right, because they're no longer as good as randomly assigned to the provider. So I think it's I don't want to suggest that you can just grab one of these three. I think you mentioned this, Matt, these three instruments and run with it in any context. Most of the time, you're going to realize that the context really matters for the instrument to work. And if you take the McClellan piece, you know, these were people who had essentially were taken by ambulance to the nearest hospital because they had a heart problem. And the discussion was, if you're randomly taken to the nearest hospital, which has a lot of resources and does sort of aggressive heart procedures, they can track what happens thereafter. But those circumstances don't always hold in a lot of things, or we just don't have the data to confirm that.
Yes, I agree with you. I also agree with the general recommendation that sort of just using these as hammers without being thoughtful about the context is definitely not recommended. I think, you know, in any specific clinical context, being able to convince the smartest clinicians you know who work in this, any area, the clinical area you're trying to do this in, that your instrument is uncorrelated with the outcome or residuals of the outcome is really important. If they don't buy your story about the second assumption, which the second assumption is here, then it's probably not valid, right? And also another issue is that sometimes instruments don't have enough variation in them to be powered to even meet the first assumption. Regional level variation can sometimes fail because there's not enough variation in the instrument, because maybe the regions are so large or something, or there's just not a whole lot of variation in the provision of them across region.
Have you, with regard to that first assumption, have you, so we've, on some of our studies, struggled, because you'll see this partial F statistic when you add in the instrument or you don't include it, to see it, it's highly significant, but it's an F statistic, partial F statistic of, let's say, 5.
Right.
And have you played around with how rigorous that sort of cutoff? And there's been other papers, a recent one that got a lot of publicity a year or two ago, that says it really should be closer to 100 as a partial F statistic.
Yeah, I've seen that. And yeah, I tend to not trust results with an F statistic of 5. I think closer to 100 or well over 100 is much more defensible, I think, because reviewers will skewer you. I think this rule of thumb still is pretty strong, and I think reviewers will definitely skewer you.
Is there, so what do you do in the situation where you've done all your work and your instrument is not as strong? Do you have any recommendations? Run to your next study?
Either write a longer limitation section or try changing the functional form of the instrument. If it's plausible that, you know, higher order terms, if it's continuous, is a reasonable, clinically reasonable thing to consider in predicting treatment. But barring that, I think you just have to write a long limitation section.
Okay. Yeah, the one thing that we've struggled with is how much do you do the trade-off of looking at subsamples for whom the instrument is stronger, but of course, the narrower the subsample, you're losing sample size. And so your estimates are, you know, less generalizable and often less powered in a smaller sample too.
And you're also, if you're trying to relate an IV analysis to some analysis that doesn't account for selection, anything you're doing, you know, the generalizability hit of subsetting your sample to try to juice the F statistic limits the generalizability of your analysis. And then even further among the compliers within that subsample.
So a question came up, and they loved your example of the Charlie Sheen and the Joe Biden and you and Courtney. In VA data or in clinical data sets, how do you distinguish between the you and Courtney versus the Charlie and Joe's?
Well, I'd say full disclosure, I haven't implemented the Baiocchi method, but I think that provides a way to, where is that? But that is a way you can try to characterize. If you look at the Werner paper, they describe essentially the ways in which compliers generated using these sort of statistics differ in a table one sort of structure from the overall cohort. And so I think I would look at the Werner paper for how they did it and then refer to this 2014 paper to do it. I can't speak to it beyond that. I'm sorry.
The one thing I would add, just because we've done a little bit of this, is using clinical characteristics to say, if the patient has these characteristics that would make them, you know, always be done this way, and you can observe those characteristics, then you might be able to say, oh, we have some, you know, models or proxies that would identify the people like a Joe Biden, and you can exclude them from the data set. And you know, if you have this same kinds of CDW data where you can reliably estimate your Charlie Sheens, you could exclude them from the data set. So if you're doing a surgery study, for example, you might identify people who have extensive comorbidities and would, because of these comorbidities, would always be handled one way. And then you can decide that they're not really a marginal patient.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable for storytelling. It doesn't provide the, you know, statistical sample restriction, right? A strict sample restriction to be able to say how to, who the marginal patients are. I mean, if going back to our discussion about how the signs switched in the Werner paper between the covariate adjusted and the IV analysis, right? If the results are all in the same direction, unlike that Werner paper, right? I think it might, you might feel comfortable saying that couching the IV results in the context of the overall results when the sign switches like this, it is a harder problem. And, you know, if there's, let me just say, things get a lot simpler if people are expected to be, have a homogeneous response to treatment, in which case IV results generalize the entire sample. But in the case of this home health, discharge to home health versus SNF, I wouldn't expect that to be the case, but I don't know enough about this clinical population and management of patients in these settings to be able to speak to that. But I think having a deep substantive knowledge of the treatment and the population and the treatment settings is really critical to make sense of these results.
Yeah, I totally agree with the institutional knowledge there. I've heard people often quip that a great quantitative study often includes a great qualitative study, because you often have to get that institutional knowledge by, you know, talking to people at the site or clinicians to understand exactly how processes work.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I'll hold here in case anybody else has any other questions. Of the papers, the paper that I was going to just highlight was your paper in JAMA. I think it's a great paper for people who might have a less experience with econometrics and more clinical experience, and just want to point that out. So if you can go to the paper citations, Matt.
Let's see. I can do that. Sorry. It is, yeah, it's Norton, Dowd, and Machieski in JAMA in 2022.
Yep.
Volume 327. Issue 12.
Here's so now all of a sudden, as we're running up to the end, we're getting questions popping in. So thank you, folks. Often we are interested in interpreting the effect of a policy or program, not individual decisions, like the effect of inviting people for screening, not individuals getting screened. How does that play into the discussions of different types of patients?
Let me see. Let me pull up that question in the chat. That's often interrelated to policy. I agree, we're not interested in individual decisions, right? The individual decisions, we can't model individual decisions. All we can do is characterize average treatment effects or average treatment effects of the treated. But we know, we're not interested in individual decisions, but we may be interested in, we may be concerned that there's heterogeneity of treatment effects, that different patients respond differently. And borrowing from Rod Hayward's classification, there's two settings in which heterogeneity matters. The first is, say, the simple case of a null trial, a null study, but that null masks two responses. One, where people do well and actually benefit from the treatment, and a subset who are harmed. And when you average all that together, it's null. But in fact, like in the Lake Orbegon, there's no average patient. There's people who benefit and people who are harmed. The other is, and I think this is very common for the VA, where there's treatments that are beneficial. Some people get above average benefit. Some people say get just an average benefit, and some people get little to no benefit. And it's a treatment where the need, obesity is what comes to mind, vastly exceeds the potential supply. And so in those settings where we want to consider it heterogeneity and endogeneity or selection, marginal patients get that, but not cleanly, if you will, the way, say, causal forest methods or different heterogeneity methods and trials might be able to identify clinically coherent subgroups. This causal forest may be a way, it's a machine learning method developed by Susan Athey and others at Stanford where Todd is, that may get us there. But I don't know, Todd, if you have used those methods in any of your work.
I haven't. No. I was actually thinking this from an analogous point of view of the clinical trials. So a clinical trial is often trying to understand a policy or program or a treatment, not individual decisions. And then it gets complicated if there's a lot of crossover or dropout. So we'll do these trials where we'll recommend certain things, and you really only get the sort of average treatment effect, but it includes that dropout. And so there's a question about, well, what if we look at the people who complied with the treatment? Well, you're sort of breaking the randomized trial in that regard. And a bunch of people said, hey, well, let's just use instrumental variables there as the way to get around that. And so that there is a way to combine those two where the randomization is your instrument, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So that's to get at dose response. But even if people who are fully adherent to a treatment that requires some effort repeatedly, there may be different responses to that, right? Some people may be really protected by a COVID vaccine and others less so. That's just mixing treatments, sorry. But characterizing heterogeneity is very hard. And IV methods do it in this marginal patient way that doesn't identify clinically coherent subgroups, which is what I think a lot of methods for heterogeneity of treatment effects and trials try to do. I see Michelle commented that you really need to understand the context to select a good IV, and I think that's right, echoing what Todd wrote back. IVs, when they meet the assumptions, work incredibly well, but I think it's a lot harder to find valid IVs than I initially thought getting out of grad school, figuring I had this hammer I could use all over the place and crashed and burned in a lot of situations. So my recommendation is get the smartest people you know on your team, or grab people that you respect who aren't on your team and pitch them ideas on IVs. Because I think it's creativity is essential in trying to use this method.
Well, thank you, Matt. I don't see any other questions, and we're right at the top of the hour. So before people sprint off to get to their next Zoom meeting or to their next meeting, I know we have a survey question that is going to pop up, and we really value the input. But I just wanted to thank you, Matt, for a great presentation today.
Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity to present to you all.
And Rob, can I pass it back to you?
Sure. Thanks. You basically did my job for me. So I'll just go ahead and close and say thanks to everybody. Have a good day.